Today's program is proudly brought to you by Whole Foods Market. Visit wholefoodsmarket.com or download the Whole Foods Market app to learn more and find the store nearest to you.
You're listening to Heritage Radio Network. We're a member-supported food radio network broadcasting over 35 weekly shows live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. Join our hosts as they lead you through the world of craft brewing, behind the scenes of the restaurant industry, inside the battle over school food, and beyond. Find us at heritageradionetwork.org.
You're listening to Food Without Borders on Heritage Radio Network. I'm your host, Sari Kamen. Today in studio, well, actually on the line, my guest is Simran Sethi. She's a journalist and an educator focused on food sustainability and social change. She was named the Environmental Messenger by Vanity Fair and designated one of the top 8 women saving the planet by Marie Claire. Simran is the creator of The Slow Melt, the first podcast on the continuum of chocolate, winner of the 2017 Savour Award for Best Food Podcast. She is also the author of Bread, Wine, Chocolate, The Slow Loss of Foods We Love. The book tells the story of changes in food and agriculture through bread, wine, chocolate, coffee, and beer, and was named one of the best food books of 2016 by Smithsonian. Wow. Welcome to the show, Simran.
Thank you. Thank you for that superlative introduction.
Well, those are just facts. I mean, that's just unbelievable. And it goes on and on and on. I mean, it's just, you're just really one of the most impressive people that I've ever had the pleasure of speaking with, that I'm now speaking with you. So I'm very happy to have you here, having long admired your work and your podcast and your writing. So it's really just an honor to have you on the show. Thank you so much for being here.
Mama, thank you.
And you're so nice. And you told me that you just got back to the United States from Italy.
Yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So what were you doing there?
I am definitely living my best life, and you can be very jealous of that.
Yeah, that is a good place to live one's best life.
Yeah.
They have it figured out, don't they?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Did you drink a lot of wine and eat a lot of bread and chocolate?
You know it. And beer and coffee. I live my book every day. I actually was in Torino for the International Food Journalism Conference. So it was a perfect excuse to share the gospel on chocolate and climate change and kind of how journalists report on the issue, and also indulge in a lot of good wine and many cappuccini and chocolate too.
So, yeah, it's a good healthy balance. Good. Well, we're going to get to your book that covers more of all of those delicious things you just mentioned, but I want to just kind of back up and hear a little bit about your upbringing, which is interesting. I mean, you're Indian, but you were born in Germany. So you're the child of Indian immigrants, I'm assuming. What was your upbringing like? What was it like to be Indian in Germany? How long did you live there for?
Not long. Mm-hmm. So my dad got his PhD in Germany, and my mom joined him there. She was finishing up her master's and then came over from India, and I was born there. And then, shortly thereafter, the National Institutes of Health asked my dad to come to the United States. He was a clinical pharmacologist working in cancer research, so looking at particular drugs that, you know, that might be able to combat cancer. So I was just a baby when we came to the U.S., and it was so interesting because I asked my mom quite a bit about that experience and, you know, what she'd seen of the United States at that point. This is 1971, was like on television, and they got here toward the end of the day, and it was dark, and it wasn't as shiny and glittery as, you know, television portrayed it. So it was a real kind of adjustment. And then from there, you know, spent a couple of years in the D.C. area and then mainly grew up in North Carolina. So I've had this sort of dual experience of being Indian and having a whole life there. You know, I'd go back and visit my family in India, not really any time in Germany until I was an adult, and then also growing up in the South. So having these two really different experiences, you know, come together in little me.
Yeah. And what was the food like in your household growing up? Because you lived, like you said, in the South, but I imagine that, you know, there was some more traditional Indian food that your mom prepared as well.
Yeah, exactly. So, so it was a little bit of both. So I think it's a typical immigrant kid experience where your mom is making you, or your dad, whomever, somebody is making like this gorgeous food, you know, handmade, wonderful deliciousness. And what you really want is the like shitty tater tots and pizza from the school cafeteria. You know?
Yeah, that's like such a running theme.
Why can't I have a bologna sandwich like everyone else? Like,
right.
Why do I have to have delicious curries and dolls? And, you know, so I kind of hid it away. I'm sure I threw away a lot of my lunches. And only as I got older did I realize how lucky I was. And I really do have that dual experience. Like, I'm just as comfortable with, you know, grits and mac and cheese and barbecue. North Carolina barbecue is the superior barbecue for anyone who has any question about that. But then also, you know, all my northern Indian Punjabi foods, straight up, you know, rajma, bharta, like all the kind of traditional things I'm a real sucker and stickler for. So
yeah.
So I live these things simultaneously.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I've heard that from several guests on this show who had just the exact same experience of being sort of ashamed of the food that they were served in their home and just wanting to fit in. And like, especially if something, you know, showed up in their lunchbox or their lunch bag, trying to hide it. And you said that actually in your book that, you know, you said for every immigrant that food is a source of solace and shame. Anything that would allow you, you craved anything that would allow you to fit in rather than stand out.
Yeah. It's true. You know, I mean, I was like a brown girl in the Bible Belt, and we got here to North Carolina, and one of the first questions I was asked was, you know, is Christ your Savior? And I didn't even really know what that meant, you know, and I said, no. And then, you know, this little toe-headed kid said, well, then you're going to hell, you know, and it's like,
oh my God.
What? Where am I, you know? And so, and for the record, I'm Hindu, you know, and so it's like this kind of experience where what you want to do is not stand out, yet everything about you kind of points to this otherness, you know. It was literally in that day checking a box. I wasn't black, I wasn't white, I was other, and always trying to fit in. And you know, one of the biggest ways that we kind of come together, as you well know, of course, is through food. And so it was this, you know, even though my friends would come over and they would love the food that my mom would make and they'd want to come over again and again, for me, I just wanted to be as straight up American as I could be. And, you know, that meant I got colored contacts, that meant I got a perm, you know, that meant I did all this weird stuff. But the thing that seemed easiest to kind of, you know, change, as it were, was my diet. But it really, as I got older again, it became this extraordinary, I mean, badge of honor is too extreme, but this real sense of pride that I had this much longer story and history. And it, you know, it connected me all the way back to India and my grandmother. And you know, that is actually now one of the things I'm most, that I cherish the most, you know? So it's almost like I look back at my younger self and wonder, like, why were you so embarrassed? You know, like, I wish I could go back and kind of remedy that from that early age.
Well, I think just like being a young person is just difficult anyway. Like, we're all so insecure and like uncomfortable with ourselves. And then having this like extra thing that made you feel like you stood out. I mean, I'm sure everyone feels like they stand out to a certain extent, but you, like, yours was so, you know, like on the surface and obvious. I mean, it probably was like, well, it's probably just like humiliating having friends come over. And even though they appreciated the food, it probably felt more like like they were like fetishizing the other, you know, like just sort of like exacerbating like something that, you know, you were already really like trying to push down beneath the surface a little bit.
Yeah, that's very interesting. And, you know, I mean, I stood out from everything, my skin color, my name, like there was no hiding.
Yeah, yeah.
And so maybe it was also this idea of like, I could take refuge in food. But the thing that I have to say, I really quite loved the friends of mine who were like obsessed with my mom's food because it was validation that I needed. Whatever their motive was, I think it was like, my mom is like an amazing cook. So there's that. And then there was just that level of like, I have never had anything like this in my life, and it's blowing my mind, you know, and it made me feel a little bit excited. And you know, I wouldn't go so far as to say proud, but in that moment, there was just like a little bit of recognition that I had, that all of my otherness was quite special and interesting.
Yeah. It's nice to like grow into that. And like, that's, I think that's just part of like becoming an adult, being like, oh,
yeah,
I am who I am. And like, it's actually pretty awesome.
Yeah,
but you moved to India when you were 26. So what took you there?
So I actually worked for MTV News for quite a while.
Oh.
And first in New York when I was still in college. And then after college, they kind of lured me back. They were doing a special on the rise of neo-Nazism and popular music. And then from there, I was asked to actually be on air for MTV Asia. And then I ended up running the news department for MTV India. So I had gone to India my whole life, you know, seeing my family. But when you, and again, I think not an uncommon experience, like when you go back to the homeland, you're not seeing the sights. You're like sitting with your family endlessly, you know, and just doing nothing. And so I got to rediscover India, and this was also in Mumbai, so a totally different part from where I was, you know, where my family's from. But that's kind of what brought me back and allowed me to rediscover and reconnect with kind of my Indian-ness in a whole new way, and, you know, different kinds of cuisine. Like, I didn't know that particular Maharashtrian cuisine at all, or sort of Parsi cuisine, or any of the cuisines that are kind of more popular in that area, go in, et cetera, et cetera. So it was a really exciting time for me to kind of discover myself and then discover this, like what I thought I knew of Indian food was just the tip of the iceberg.
Yeah, I'm sure. So kind of like to the point of what we were just saying, you know, I read that you wrote when you got to India, you know, you were so excited to like experience all this food that you didn't get when you were growing up, but then it sort of transitioned and you were craving what was familiar to your like American sensibilities, which was, you know, whatever, like salad and lasagna. And then you were like secretly happy when a McDonald's opened up.
I know.
Which I think is so funny.
I can't even, because the thing was, it is that, right? There's always this experience of longing for this other thing.
Yeah, I mean, you probably couldn't even have predicted that. You would have felt that way.
Yeah. I definitely, I mean, because the thing was with all these other, and it's definitely different now, but back then it was sort of like, no matter what food you were getting, it was interpreted through the lens of India, right? So
right.
The spices would be like, Italian food would be a little bit off, or Chinese, you know, there's a whole tradition of like Indo-Chinese cuisine. And so I just wanted like a straight up, pure, unadulterated French fry, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And so I got it. I mean, there was the first McDonald's that opened in that area, opened in my neighborhood, which is called, is Bandra. You know, so my ex and I would like get in the car. We'd like wait in line sometimes when it first opened, I think, or, you know, it became something that I do periodically just to kind of reconnect to that part of myself, which is a little bit embarrassing because I don't want to think like the most American part of myself is like, you know, a happy meal, but it was definitely a nice way to ground.
Yeah. It's, I mean, I guess that's a very pure part of yourself. But it's just,
I mean, you know, I always sort of freak out when I think about all the, like the people who go, you know, away after they graduate from college here in the US and then they go to like wherever they go and they go to the McDonald's and it's like, oh my gosh, are you kidding? Like, why would you go there? But I mean, after a certain point of having so much Indian food and also there's not a lot of tradition of like fresh salads and stuff,
right.
Most vegetables are cooked. I was like, I just really want a big salad and like, you know, some French fries and a fillet of fish, you know?
It's just it's so interesting.
Yeah,
because you write so much about like how food is connected to memory, and like loss of like the sense of losing oneself as foods, you know, become more threatened. And like you write about agricultural biodiversity, and it's just kind of like amusing to think about you eating French fries in India.
You know, it's all like tied up together and mm-hmm. confusing, because that loss of culture, that erosion. So look, this is, you know, a couple of decades ago. So I want to sort of say, like, I have really evolved. I'm not that same woman. Not that I was a huge, like, fast food eater back then, but now it's really, I mean, I can't tell you the last time I was in a McDonald's, but, and no judgment for anybody who does that sort of thing. But for me, it's really been like that homogenization is something that I don't really want to embrace anymore. And that would include even my job. You know, I worked at MTV. Like, popular culture is one of the biggest exports the United States offers the world. And so I was also a part of that cultural shift, which I'm not too happy about either. So I think it's really like understanding some of this stuff on a deeper level. And we could say, yeah, but, you know, McDonald's also had the veggie burger. I mean, there was an interpretation of McDonald's that was uniquely Indian. And MTV India was very different than MTV in the United States. And both these things are true. But, you know, at its core, it's about kind of taking something else away and making like the world a little bit similar, right? So I really, in you know, the last like 15, 20 years, what I really want to celebrate is difference again. I don't want us to be this giant melting pot where everything kind of blends in and melts together. I want us to be, you know, like there's a sociological description around this, but it's more like a goulash or a stew, right? Mm-hmm. Where it's like you come together, but all the pieces are still discrete. So you've got your chunks of meat and potatoes and carrots and what have you, and the integrity around those things. So it's like, can I be an American and still have my Indian-ness? You know, can we celebrate different cuisines and not feel like we have to make, you know, something like American fast food or now processed foods, you know, convenience foods, the baseline. And that's what I'm really curious to explore, because that ties directly into, you know, it's not only a cultural loss, but it's this kind of agricultural loss of biodiversity. And these things aren't separate, you know, they're happening in tandem.
Yeah. Yeah. And I mean, you also pointed out that was like the first McDonald's, you know, that you had seen. It wasn't like McDonald's is so pervasive in India now. Like, it was an actual novelty when that McDonald's opened up too. So maybe you would have felt differently. You know, maybe you wouldn't have felt like that French fry was probably like a little exotic in that moment to you, because it was different than everything exactly. you'd been eating. It was before, you know, like this globalization, like the Airbnb-ification of the world where everyone can go everywhere and it's so easy. And, you know, one of the byproducts of that is like everything is sort of becoming the same.
Yeah, exactly. And it's shocking to me that like it does take on this kind of local, I don't know if patina is really the right word, but in France, for example, you know, it's like it's McDo. And there are, I think, more McDonald's per capita in France than anywhere else in the world. And it's a sense of ownership, or like KFC or Pizza Hut, you know. And I just think to myself, like, wow, we've exported. This is what we exported? Like, okay, you know, like, I think I can, we've got some other stuff we could offer that's even cooler, guys, you know? So,
yeah.
so there's also that part of it that I find really interesting, that it does kind of become part of the fabric of these other places, you know, and uniquely theirs as well.
Yeah. Well, let's get to your book, because that's what we're really here for. So, so bread, wine, chocolate, coffee, and beer. How did you hone in on those particular foods to research?
Yeah. So I'll back up and say the book is about the loss of agricultural biodiversity,
yeah,
which is the loss of diversity and kind of everything that makes food and drink possible, right? So from a loss of diversity in the soil to seeds to pollinators to plants to animals and aquatic life. So initially the book was going to be like wheat, rice, potatoes, the slow loss of foods we love, you know, like really staple foods, you know, the things that kind of anchor the global diet, what have you. And I was sitting in my like tiny postcard sized apartment in Rome, and I was struggling with the corn chapter. And I thought to myself, my God, Michael Pollan has written the best chapter on corn in The Omnivore's Dilemma. Like, how am I going to top that, A? And B, I'm not even a corn person. Like, I'm not really going to miss corn. It's not, you know, whatever.
Yeah.
And so
Corn's no chocolate.
Back to the U.S. Sorry?
Corn's no chocolate.
Yeah, right, exactly. Corn is no chocolate. Unless maybe, I don't know, maybe in Mexico, maize is chocolate and chocolate is maize. I don't know. But, you know, I'm sitting there and I'm struggling. And then I do all my research in Italy and I come back to the United States and I had like gone to the farmer's market with my sister in Oakland, California, and we ran into her neighbor, and her neighbor's husband is a chocolate maker. And so I ended up visiting him. I didn't realize until that encounter that he was also a botanist. So it was going to be this really interesting conversation. And I'd always thought like, okay, I'm going to write this book on, you know, wheat and rice and throw a little wine in for color and a little sprinkle of chocolate on top. It'll be a sidebar. But what happened when I went and met that chocolate maker was I realized how integral chocolate was to my life, like how that was something I actually missed. And the reason I missed it in that particular moment was because I had, like, you know, consumed so much wine in Italy. I decided to go on a little mini cleanse. And so I was like not having any sugar or booze. And so in these days when I met this guy, Brad, I wasn't eating chocolate. And so I felt acutely that loss. And I realized I needed to change this book and talk about things that I really loved so I could convey that emotion. And maybe they weren't like dietary staples, but they were anchors in my life. You know, coffee is what wakes me up every day. Chocolate, I eat every single day of my life. You know, wine is something we celebrate with. Beer actually wasn't my thing, but it is so many people's things. I also wanted to work with a drink that I knew people loved that I wanted to learn to love, you know, and sort of share that experience. And then, you know, bread is kind of, it's a dietary staple. It's a spiritual staple. It's like something that we love, you know. So I just thought that was another great one to talk about. And there was a much longer list at a certain point, but it kind of got winnowed down to these foods and drinks.
Yeah. We're going to take a quick break for the commercial, but we're going to come back and talk more about how you kind of navigated the journeys of these foods.
Okay.
Thanks, Simran.
Today's program is brought to you by Whole Foods Market. From papayas and samosas to reishi mushrooms, if it's something that sounds delicious, chances are you'll find the freshest, best version of it at Whole Foods Market. They have more than 400 stores across the country, so if you consider pizza its own food group or just can't imagine when avocado toast wasn't a thing, Whole Foods Market has you covered. Visit wholefoodsmarket.com to find a store near you. Whole Foods Market. Whatever makes you whole.
You're listening to Food Without Borders on heritageradionetwork.org. I am your host, Sari Kamen, and I'm on the line with Simran Sethi. She is the author of Bread, Wine, Chocolate, The Slow Loss of Foods We Love. And we have just begun kind of digging into the book. And Simran, you were just starting to tell us about bread, wine, chocolate, coffee, and beer, which are the particular foods that you focus on in your book. How did you, I mean, you spent, what, 5 years working on this book? And six
yes,
continents, is that
they
right?
They were like dog years.
I'm sure.
Yep. Six continents, 5 years. It was a pretty, it was a life-changing experience.
Yeah.
It really was. Yeah.
How can you even, like, sum up what that was like for you? I mean, like, where did you go? How did you find the people you interviewed? How did you figure out where you were going to travel to next?
Yeah, it was crazy, Sari, because I didn't know what I was doing. I mean,
you quit your job and like television. Sold your house and everything to like just go do this?
Yeah, I did.
That's so cool.
When I was working for NBC News, the publisher approached me and said, "Hey, do you want to write a book?" I was like, "Well, I don't write books. I report the news on television." You know, like I didn't, you know, and they wanted me to write a book and I sold a different book. And then I had this weighing over me, which is a strange phenomenon as I moved through careers, as I became a journalism professor, as I got tenure, you know, and I just have this book that's weighing on me and I want to write, but I don't yet know how. Mm. And over the course of time, I realized what I wanted to write about. The book evolved a number of times, but when I was in Italy on a separate trip, I had met a researcher at a place called Bioversity International, and they're the only NGO that really focuses on agricultural biodiversity and conservation, like on farms and in the wild. So they're really important in terms of kind of conservation. And the scientist, you know, I was looking at genetic engineering and seeds, and he said, you know, GMOs are really a big deal in your country, but in Italy, first of all, they're banned. But he said, you know, what we're really concerned about is the loss of agricultural biodiversity. And I had heard about it, you know, reading books like by Gary Nabin, for example. But I always thought what we were losing were these esoteric things, like a wild rice I would never encounter or some esoteric squash. And what this gentleman, Stefano Padulosi, helped me to understand was this erosion was happening to all foods at all times. And that really impacted me, that I cared so much about food. I taught, you know, almost every class I could teach, I taught through the lens of food. I was, you know, obsessed with kind of what I was eating, how I was eating, not in a, like, maybe healthful way, but trying to understand it from a cultural perspective. And here I didn't know, you know, that foods were endangered. And so I ended up quitting my job that I couldn't get fired from. I sold my house, I gave away my car, and I started on this journey. And I mapped it out, knowing that I wanted to talk about this loss in every conceivable way. So, for example, from the soil, right? So that I talk about in my wine chapter, the loss of biodiversity in soil. But I also wanted to talk about the different ways we conserve biodiversity. So there's three primary ways. There's ex situ conservation, which is kind of external collections like a seed bank, you know, or the Svalbard Global Seed Vault. And then there's in situ, which is Latin for in-place conservation, which happens in the wild and on farms. So in the wild, I went to the birthplace of coffee, which is Ethiopia, to the exact place where coffee, you know, was allegedly grown for the first time, right? So for the chocolate chapter, I went to the area. It's a bean-shaped area, you know, between Ecuador and Peru, where chocolate comes from. And I wanted to talk about conservation of cocoa on farms. You know, so I had these kind of ideas of what I wanted to share. The beer chapter talks about the loss of agricultural biodiversity in microbes. So I went to an external collection. Instead of going to a seed bank, I actually went to a yeast bank where they store, it's one of the biggest collections of yeast in the world, in Norwich in the UK. And then I traced a yeast that they had saved all the way back to a beer at a brewery in London that was at one time one of the biggest breweries in the world. And you know, they kind of, those beers fell out of favor, and so that kind of disappeared. And the way they brought that beer back to life, so to speak, was through this yeast. So
that's wild.
Really, what I wanted to do was make this stuff alive for people, you know? And I thought, like, if I can go to the forest in Ethiopia and I can tell you what it's like, even if you never go there, maybe you'll feel those pangs of loss. Like, if I can introduce you to those farmers, you know? And one of the things I was really adamant about was naming everyone. So there's not a single person that I encounter on the book, whether it was the driver, you know, who drove me from point A to point B, or an intern at the cocoa farm, who doesn't get named. Because so often it's like farmers in fields, you know, or workers in factories. And that anonymity is the way we lose connection. You know, it's distance, and it's this erasure of humanity. And like, if nothing else, what this book, I hope, did was place people front and center. You know, I never expected to be like the main character, but my editor kept saying, like, more of you. And I was like, what? This is terrible. I don't want to talk about myself. But it became the way. Like, I became the guide through kind of like the journeys of these foods and drinks, and helping people, you know, maybe understand them a little bit more. Because I thought I knew everything I needed to know about coffee. You know, it's like, I like cappuccinos. You know, like, that's it. I'm good. And it's like, you don't know anything about coffee, sister. Like, there's so much to learn. And through, like, learning about these foods and drinks, I really have come to appreciate and love them more.
Yeah, and I mean, what's so fantastic about the book and like having you, you know, as sort of like the conduit making all these connections for us is that, you know, I think like the average person doesn't know that we have lost so much. Like, there's no sense of grief or concern or like mourning, because we're not even aware that these things ever existed. It's like when you talk about in the beginning, like how there used to be, you know, however many varieties of banana, now there's one banana. Mm-hmm. It's like, well, we don't even feel sad about that because we don't, like, we don't even know that that was a thing. So
it's so important to create this emotional we do in the world, but we see one, right? Or you think like there's all this abundance. When I was saying, I'm going to write a book about the loss of agricultural biodiversity. One of my friends was like, have you been to a grocery store? Like, what are you talking about? We have more diversity than ever. But what we have is largely, you know, an illusion. It's like, so I went to the grocery store, I counted up a bunch of things. The most surprising example for me was in dairy products. 90% of the dairy products that we consume in the United States come from one breed of cow, right? So, like, you can imagine if that breed gets knocked out, if it succumbs to a disease, if something, you know, happens because of, you know, a warming planet, like, that a lot is in peril, you know? And now 3/4 of our food comes from 12 plant and 5 animal species. And we can grow so much more, we can raise so much more, and we can have this diversity of experience, of flavor that we're missing out on. Because what we breed animals and plants to do typically is for yield, right, to increase the yield, or for disease or pest resistance. So we're not breeding them for flavor. Like, you know, the idea is kind of like, I go to the grocery store to buy things I want to eat that are delicious, you know, or the farmer's market. I'm not doing it for, like, the highest yield. But the banana, for example, that we see on store shelves was bred for stability. So, you know, shelf stability and for shipping easily. It's not there for our nutritional benefit necessarily, or for our sensorial benefit. And that is something I also include in the book, is tasting guides and like a breakdown of how our senses work. So when I say to people, hey, there's all these awesome, you know, varieties of coffee that you could be drinking. If you've only ever had, I don't know, Folgers, you're not even going to be able to discern that stuff. I mean, right. I couldn't either. I didn't know about this loss. I didn't know how to navigate these foods and drinks. You know, I understood the sense of kind of diversity and terroir and something like cheese or wine, but not in bread or chocolate. And so as I discovered them, I wanted to share that information with other people and make sure that it was as democratic as possible. Like, you don't need to go to an expert. You are your own best expert, always. No one has the experience you have. No one has the physiology you have. Of course, sommeliers and cicerones and, you know, kind of experts can give guidance. But at the end of the day, like, you love what you love, and understanding that will only enable you to find more of that stuff that you love, you know, and kind of appreciate diversity and expand your palate and, you know, hopefully in the process, preserve biodiversity.
So now you have a podcast called The Slow Melt, which is wonderful. So you focus on chocolate. I mean, how is just, you know, such a, not that it's a small topic, but just one food, how is that like this huge lens to talk about all these different sustainability issues around the world?
Yeah. So it's interesting because I talked about all these, this handful of foods and drinks, but the one that I really fell most deeply for was chocolate. And I came back and I have like a million chocolate stories I want to tell, and I'm pitching them to editors, and they all really want me to sort of talk about recipes, or they say, you know, like, this isn't the season for chocolate. I remember I pitched something in June and I was like, what? Like, are you, what? I
can't. Why? Because it's not Valentine's Day.
Like, every day is chocolate day.
Every day is chocolate day.
This is the New York Times, by the way.
Wow.
So I was like, look, if you guys aren't going to let me tell these stories, I'm going to do it myself.
Yeah.
And so I had my microphone, you know, left over from my like days of working at an environmental website called Tree Hugger. And I used to do segments for them for Air America Radio. And I basically like threw a blanket over my head and, you know, found some great people to work with who work at NPR affiliates in Los Angeles, and you know, I knew how to kind of tell a story. And so for me, you know, initially the challenge was, like, I can tell the story of agricultural biodiversity through bread, wine, coffee, chocolate, and beer. But really, you can tell the story of everything through a singular food, and that's what chocolate has done. And the reason I chose chocolate was, A, because I love it immensely, and B, because I'm not alone in that. Mm-hmm. So if I want to talk to you about, you know, climate change, sure, I can talk to you about sea level rise, and I get, because I have, actually, I did that on NBC. I did that in a number of outlets. But what if I can tell you about that story through something that you already love? And, you know, what if I can tell you the story of labor and economics through chocolate? And what if I can tell you the story of chemistry and flavor? And I want to do all of these things. So that's why I started the podcast, was really to sort of say, like, there are so many stories that we can talk about through food. And I think this particular lens, this thick, delicious, melty lens is the perfect one, you know? So that became sort of the conduit to talking about everything from geography and history to chemistry and climate change.
So cool. I just have time for one more question. And I watched a TEDx talk that you gave quite a while ago. I mean, it's maybe almost a decade ago, but it was such an interesting topic because you weren't talking about chocolate at that point. Mm-hmm. You were talking about sort of the realization that despite how different people seem from each other, we're actually much more similar than we realize. And the context was, like, you had moved to Kansas from New York and you had become friends with someone who seemed so, you know, he couldn't be more different than you. He was a hunter and he was conservative. And then you just discovered this love for local food and, you know, growing your own food or foraging or whatever it was. And you really found this common ground. And kind of like the thesis of your talk was that we're actually so much more similar than we're not. And I mean, my question just watching this, because it was several years ago, was like, do you still feel like that? Like after, you know, the election and, you know, being from a red state, and like, do you still have that strong belief?
So, the psychology has also evolved, and now there has been a lot more nuanced research on kind of the difference between the conservative, quote unquote, conservative and liberal brains, right? So I talk about this talk you're referencing is the green brain, and this idea that we're all kind of wired to want certain things, you know, and that generally we are more alike than different. That is absolutely true from a kind of genetic and physiological perspective, as well as from like a perspective of like what we want in the world. We want to connect with other people. We want to, you know, and we also want agency. We want to kind of set ourselves apart in the world. But when it gets to the specifics now, I have to say it's been an extraordinarily painful time for me. Yeah. And I do feel like the differences are in like acute, right?
They're just profound.
They're more pronounced than they've ever been. I still believe though that one of the most powerful ways we can come back together is through food and over food, because no matter what our political affiliation, our gender, our ethnicity, our class, whatever, like we all eat or want to eat. And if we can really connect through feeding our hungers, I think it's still possible to return to each other.
Yeah, I hope so.
Yeah, me too. I really do.
That's why I come each week. Well, Simran, thank you so much. I mean, there's just so much to talk about, and obviously I would love to keep this conversation going much longer, but it's the time where I get kicked out. So why don't you tell everyone like where we can listen to your podcast and read your writing and find your books and just stay in touch?
Yeah, you bet. So it's the podcast is theslowmelt.com, and my website, which is where all my writing ends up, and you can find out what I'm doing. I'm all over Europe this summer doing a ton of speaking engagements, and here in the U.S., it's simransethi.com. It's SimranSethi.com.
Great.
And also, you can find me on Twitter and Instagram at simransethi.
Perfect. Well, thank you. It has just been such a delicious experience, enriching. Just lovely.
Likewise.
Yeah, thanks. Get some rest, recover from your jet lag, and if you haven't read the book yet, it's so fascinating and fun and exciting, and it's just like the best, most pleasurable way to read about biodiversity that you could imagine.
Thank you.
Yeah. Thanks, Simran, and thanks all for listening. We'll be back here next week, Wednesdays at 6:30 p.m.
Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to hear about exclusive events, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at @heritage_radio. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Rate the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join our community by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.
Ever wonder what kind of podcast Julia Child would have made? Probably would have been one where she introduced you to all of her latest discoveries and favorite people. And that's exactly the tradition we're following on Inside Julia's Kitchen, the podcast of the Julia Child Foundation for Gastronomy and the Culinary Arts. Join me, Todd Shulkin, your host, and the Foundation's Executive Director, as I bring you inside the Foundation's world to meet the bright lights of today's food universe, just as Julia used to do from her own famous kitchen. New episodes air on Heritage Radio Network, Wednesdays at noon Eastern. Listen in.